Hi, I'm Tedra Meyer, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus, live in VPR's Upper Valley studio in Norwich. Starting Friday, Bookstock in Woodstock is back. One of the authors who will be there is Donna Gordon, whose debut novel, What Ben Franklin Would Have Told Me, just hit bookstores. It's a story that walks through the importance of time through the lens of two guys, a 13-year-old boy dying of a rare disease, progeria, and his caretaker looking for answers about his wife who went missing during the dirty war in Argentina. Late this hour, I'll speak with Gordon about her book and what she's learned about life and death while writing it. But first, over the weekend, the CDC authorized a COVID-19 vaccine for children 6 months to 5 years old. This expands eligibility for vaccination to nearly 20 million additional children and means that Americans ages 6 months and older are now eligible for a vaccination. This is huge news for parents who have been waiting to get their kids that extra protection. But what does this mean, and what do parents and kids need to know? Today on the show, we're going to discuss the latest COVID numbers in Vermont and answer your questions when it comes to booster shots, children's vaccines, and more. To help give us a little more clarity when it comes to where we are in the pandemic, I welcome back to the show Vermont Health Commissioner, Dr. Mark Levine. Dr. Levine, welcome.
Yes, I'm here.
How are you today?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good. Let's get ready to talk all about COVID and what is going on when it comes to public health policy in the state. So, as I stated in the intro, children ages 6 months to 5 years old are now eligible for the new COVID vaccine through Pfizer and Moderna. What do we know about these two vaccines for kids? Because we know that they are different.
Yes. The Pfizer vaccine is 1/10 the dose of the adult dose, and the Moderna is 1/4 of the adult dose. The Pfizer vaccine is a three-dose series with the first two doses separated by 3 weeks and then the third dose by 8 or more weeks from the second dose. The Moderna is a two-dose series separated by 4 weeks.
Now,
we know that both vaccines are very efficacious, especially against those serious outcomes that we always talk about. And we know that they are quite safe based on the clinical trials that have just been completed. And
now,
we know
Dr.
that
Levin,
there
curious,
are going to be lots
know
of Vermont parents who have been very impatient and waiting the date for their child to get vaccinated. And vaccine is now beginning to come into the state. We pre-ordered vaccine in the preceding weeks. It was just authorized under the emergency use authorization, as you know, within the last week. And the CDC has now recommended it for all youth 6 months to under 5 years. So that means essentially anyone in the country now who's 6 months of age or older is eligible for vaccination. So we are just starting to see some of the vaccine entering the state. Because it was pre-ordered. And the Moderna has arrived first. We expect the Pfizer to be right on its heels. And I'm happy to answer any other questions people would have about them.
So David asked, he has a kid that's about to turn 5, but wants to know if he should wait a few months to get his child vaccinated or if he should go ahead and get his child vaccinated now because the dosing sizes are so different.
So he's wondering about the fact that the child might be eligible for two different doses.
Yes, so, which one to get if one involves waiting longer?
Yeah, so we're not recommending people wait longer. So I would recommend he start right now with the dose that the child is eligible for. If by the time the child gets the next dose, which would be 3 weeks or 4 weeks, age has changed, the child will then get the dose appropriate for that age. The pediatrician will be very well versed in this, and if he has any concerns at all about waiting or about how the office will handle the different dosings, he should discuss those up front first. But there's no real reason to wait, because I think so many parents have waited so long thus far that concerns about dosing should not really make you wait longer, because the doses have all been worked out for the different ages, and the pediatrician has the different dosage needs depending on the age of the child.
So, Dr. Levine, you kind of alluded to this earlier, but I'm curious what the rollout is going to look like to for the state to really make sure that the state's vaccinating as many children of this demographic.
Sure. So we anticipate the majority of vaccination will occur in pediatricians and family practitioners' offices. Just like all other vaccines for this age group, and this age group does appear and reappear in those offices frequently, the earlier in life they are, as we all know. So this is a very well-trusted site, and parents are very comfortable having their kids vaccinated in that site. There will also be a smaller proportion of kids that will be vaccinated in some of the pharmacies around the state. Pharmacies can only vaccinate age 3 and above, so that won't take care of this entire population. Our state health department district offices will also have some vaccine, and we anticipate that on our website we will have some clinics listed that will be walk-in clinics for this age group as well, and especially some of our equity-based clinics will qualify in that manner. And then finally, especially considering some of the rural areas of the state, or I should call it more rural areas, or areas where it may be a little more challenging to get to a pediatrician's office in terms of distance, we will have our EMS partners having special clinics for that population as well. So I don't think it'll be a challenge to get as many of the presumed 26,000 young people in that age range vaccinated over these ensuing weeks to months.
Now, we saw that when it came to vaccinating kids 5 to 11, schools played a huge role in getting them vaccinated. But school's now out for the summer in Vermont. What role will schools play in the vaccination push now or in the fall?
Yeah, I think they'll have very limited role now from going now into the future. As you point out, it is summertime. This is a much younger age group. Some might be in preschool, but many will be younger than that. And most of the vaccinating and boosting for older children and adolescents has pretty much occurred already, though we're still seeing some stragglers, if you will, coming to get their next booster shot. The majority have already been through that. So stepping up big-time school-based clinics isn't really going to be necessary for the rest of the vaccine effort. Now, you mentioned the fall, and the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices is meeting this month, this week and next week, actually, and we'll be discussing the issue of a potential new vaccine for the fall. This vaccine will take into account not only the earlier strains of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, but the more recent experience with things like Omicron as well. And if there's a potential for a vaccine to be deployed in the fall, that would be much more of a what I call a pan vaccine covering so much more of the field. We'll learn about that in the next week or two. And the vaccine manufacturers are already gearing up their studies, because needless to say, you would have to have the studies accomplished and results analyzed before the fall, and then vaccine manufactured and distributed in the fall to get the population appropriately managed before the end of the year.
And as these kids are getting vaccinated, what would you, from your professional opinion, what is the role of parents in monitoring their kids after their vaccine, after they get their vaccine, and what should parents look for before worrying about side effects?
Yeah, absolutely. So just like with adults and adolescents, everyone has a waiting period right after they get the vaccine, you know, in the office setting or wherever they're getting the vaccine. And that's obviously the 15, 20 minutes waiting period. Parents are so used to having their kids vaccinated with so many other vaccines that they're kind of used to watching for the type of typical side effects. Very basic ones would be, of course, discomfort in their arms and a general achiness. Some might get low-grade fevers or chills. Most of those are going to occur within the first 24 to 48 hours of getting the vaccine and then pretty much dissipate over time after that. So the core period of time is going to be the most immediate day or two after getting the vaccine.
So we have Joanne Will Phil on Twitter asks, closing testing sites ultimately harms all Vermonters. My last booster was in December. I'm unprotected against all forms of COVID now. Closing these clinics is insulting to those that stay indoors, mask, and distance because we can't afford not to. So Dr. Levine, how do you respond to people like Joanna? And listeners, to give you context, on June 25th, the state will be closing their testing sites. So, Dr. Levine, how do you respond to people like Joanna who are worried that the state's closing these testing sites?
We've received communications from a number of people like Joanna. And I guess what I would say to them is that the testing sites are most critical for use of PCR testing. And the rate of PCR testing has been diminishing over time for the last several months. And we have successfully pivoted the state, and for that matter, the country, to rapid at-home testing, most of which is with antigen testing, some of which is with a technology called LAMP, which is also a nucleic acid amplification test, somewhat like PCR. And the whole value of that is, of course, that the most recent variants that we've been seeing for some time now are very rapidly transmissible and highly transmissible. And so if people have to wait several days to get a result back on a PCR test, they're not able to do what's the most important thing, which is isolate themselves, protect others around them, without knowing what they have at that point in time. And with the rapid testing at home, which we're making very accessible to everyone for free, they can actually greatly lower their risk of spreading COVID-19 to their loved ones, to their friends, to the community that they live in. So this week, while the clinics are still open, we still have abundant take-home tests available that anyone can access, as they have been, hopefully, for several weeks now. They can still access from the federal government at COVID.gov, three rounds of tests on that website through the federal government. They can continue to go to pharmacies and use their insurance, if they have insurance, to be reimbursed for tests that they obtain there. And we will still have access to free testing over the summer months. And we'll announce at a future time exactly where and how that can be accomplished. But we anticipate people will be able to access tests through the summer and probably into the early fall as well. So the whole goal here is, again, the focus on rapid testing and rapid results. And there's very little reason for someone to need a PCR now. The major reason people have been thinking about PCRs is for international travel. And as we know, those indications are decreasing too, because many, many countries are now saying that's no longer a requirement for entry.
Now, Dr. Levine, we got an email from Laura talking about a second booster. She asks, is there any idea when a second booster will be available for people under the age of 55 without an underlying condition? My concern is getting my kids boosted for the upcoming school year and the fall. So, Dr. Levine, a question for you, for anyone under the age of 55, when can they get that second booster? But also, Laura wants to know about another booster for school-aged children.
Sure. So I would just change what Laura says to under age 50. because currently the guidance is if you're 50 or older to get that second booster. As people who have listened to me before know, I'm still very concerned that there are people, unlike Laura, who haven't got their first booster, and they've just suffered from what I would call pandemic fatigue, booster fatigue, or what have you. So I really want to urge people who never got a first booster to make sure they do that, because what we're interested in them having is protection against serious outcomes from COVID, meaning hospitalizations, ICU admission, or death. And the boosters are what is the pathway to success for that. With regard to the children and boosters, it all depends on what age group, of course, the child is. Currently, right now, there's only one booster if you're age 5 to 17, and that's at least 5 months after your second dose of vaccine. That isn't changing at this point in time in terms of the guidance. I think what would change would be if that vaccine I mentioned earlier in the call comes out in the fall. And that is the hope, that there will be a better vaccine, not just the same vaccine you've been getting, to complement what you already have and supplement what you already have. And that would occur in the fall. And that would be, I'm sure, eligible to a very broad range of ages because it is a more refined and more comprehensive vaccine. So I hope that answers her question.
Now, we touched upon this a little bit, but I want to figure out what the state's plan is for this predicted fall-winter surge.
Yeah, so nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. And, of course, one would not want to over-predict with this virus. It's fooled us many, many times. But the prediction from many experts, and the president has likewise said this, is that there may be 100 million new cases in the United States sometime in the mid to late fall or later this year. And that would presume that there would either be a marked increase in the kind of variants we've been seeing in the Northeast, but are now seeing much less of, have spread through much greater parts of the country.
Dr. Levine, we are struggling to hear you, so I'm going to have to stop you right now. We're going to wait to get our people to fix that. So hopefully when we come back, but listeners, right now we are talking with Vermont Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine. He's here to answer all of your questions. Now, Corey in Burlington asks about Paxlovid, which is an antiviral pill that people can take to avoid the worst outcomes from getting COVID. Now, Corey asks, while Paxlovid is now more widely available, there is a long list of medications and conditions for people which a person could not take it. A monoclonal antibody treatment, he asks, are monoclonal antibody treatments still available in Vermont as an infusion or a shot? And what is the effectiveness in comparison to Paxlovid? So, Dr. Levine, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes. Were you able to hear that question?
I heard part of it. Are monoclonal antibody treatments still available in Vermont in addition to the Paxlovid pills?
And, well, I think his question is, how does Paxlovid compare to the monoclonal antibodies?
Okay. So the number one go-to drug is still Paxlovid. It has the highest degree of efficacy, almost 90%. So when we talk about what's effective, Paxlovid should still be number one. We have one monoclonal antibody that's now authorized for use with Omicron and all of its subvariants, and that is called bebtelovimab. It's not an oral pill. It's an injection, an infusion, intravenously. So it makes it a little less convenient. It's also not has well worked out in terms of efficacy, but it's not known to be as efficacious as the Paxlovid. And that, in combination with the cumbersome nature of administering it, make it less attractive. The other medication that is actually a little more attractive is called remdesivir. Remdesivir, unfortunately, also needs to be given as an infusion and over three separate days, so three visits to an outpatient center, which makes that a little less attractive as well, even though it is more efficacious than the bebtelovimab. The final medication is molnupiravir, which is a pill, but it's much less efficacious than Paxlovid, so we're not using it in great numbers unless people have contraindications to the Paxlovid. So I hope you heard all of that.
Yes, yes, we did. I will let you know if we can't hear you. I want to go to the phones. Let's talk to Peter in Underhill. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Connor. My question's about two. One's about long COVID. It seems to me that that's an unaccounted cost to having people be sick for a really long time. Maybe kids of all kinds of ages possibly getting long COVID. What's the accounting for that? And with a precautionary principle, why isn't there more emphasis on not getting sick in the first place, which is good for COVID, but all other kinds of transmitted diseases and infections? And then my second
I'll ask your second question.
The second question is about frame of reference. We always hear about how Vermont's doing much better than other states, but there are a lot of other places in the world that are handling this virus very well with far fewer resources. And I'd really like to know how Vermont's doing against the best of the best.
Thanks. Peter, thanks for your call. Dr. Levine, let's start with the first question, which is about long COVID and how we are measuring long COVID, research for long COVID, and why the state isn't more focused on people not getting sick in the first place.
Yes, thank you very much for that question. I always like to focus on long COVID because it is an important sequela for some people, perhaps as many as 1 in 5 or 1 in 3, that's still being worked out. And long COVID, of course, means that several months after you had COVID, you still have persistent symptoms that can be debilitating, whether they be fatigue, shortness of breath, exercise intolerance, brain fog, you name it. So obviously, that's why I still believe that if people have the ability to try to prevent themselves from getting sick, then I completely agree with the caller, they should try to do that. That means being fully vaccinated and boosted, testing as needed, and wearing a mask at times that community transmission would warrant wearing a mask. It may mean adopting a lifestyle that is a little less social than many people want to be, and we just have to be cognizant of that. So when one asks about preventing someone from getting sick at all, we're now in an era where there are a tremendous number of transmissible variants that are very transmissible on the order of diseases from the past that were very transmissible, like chickenpox. And we find that one must be very, very careful and very highly protective to avoid getting sick at all. As most people now know, they know abundant people who got COVID, even though they felt that they were being very cautious.
Dr.
And
Levine,
now we're in a situation where...
Dr. Levine, I want to hop in here really quickly, and I want to get to Peter's second question, his frame of reference.
I just wanted to mention, now we're in a situation where some of the other costs of COVID, like impacts on mental health and substance use and chronic disease, et cetera, need to be weighed in balance with avoiding getting COVID at all, because some of those other sequela are equally or even more serious. With regard to how we're doing compared to the rest of the country and the world, Vermont still is doing extraordinarily well, because we no longer measure things on just how many cases there are. If you use metrics like the rates of hospitalization and the rates of death, we are doing extraordinarily well, whether we compare ourselves to the U.S. or other countries around the world. even the countries that were doing very, very well in the past have now had their numbers slide quite a bit because of the transmissibility of the new variants.
And Dr. Levine, we just have less than a minute with you, so I want to ask, what are you most excited about for summer?
What am I most excited about for summer? I'm excited that, you know, Vermont's community levels are going down, down, down. Hospitalizations and deaths are going down. And my hope is that people can have a much longer summer than they might have had in the previous year without as much overt concern about COVID and time to be able to do the things that they've been looking to do, whether it be enjoy our wonderful recreational opportunities, enjoy some concerts, social opportunities that they've had to put on the back burner for some time. I hope that the summer will be a very long one with regards to our freedom.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And I'm sorry, listeners, about all the technical problems that we had. That's Vermont Health Commissioner, Dr. Mark Levine. Dr. Levine, thanks so much for joining us today.